to MLB Network's Studio 42 with Bob Costas.
How do you properly introduce tonight's guest? To say that Ernie Harwell is one of baseball's Hall of Fame voices is true, but it's also insufficient. Yes, he was among the first inductees into Cooperstown's broadcast wing, but talent and craftsmanship were only part of Harwell's deep and enduring appeal. He called big league games for more than half a century, most of it with the Detroit Tigers, the team he joined in 1960, and with one brief interruption, stayed with through 2002. He was 85 when he called his last Tiger game, his voice and presence still pretty much as vibrant as the day he broke in. Over all that time, Harwell's warmth, accessibility, and genuine demeanor allowed him to forge an extraordinary connection with his listeners. He wasn't so much acclaimed as he was appreciated, not so much lauded as loved. Now, 2 months shy of his 92nd birthday, Harwell is still sharp, still looks and sounds great. But he and we now know this. Appearances notwithstanding, Ernie Harwell won't be with us much longer. He's been diagnosed with terminal cancer. He and Lulu, his wife of 68 years, have accepted that he likely has only months to live. But even as his remarkable life nears its end, Harwell's abiding decency and good-naturedness shine through. As does his love for the game, he is graced with his presence.
The Yankee pitcher Lefty Gomez once said, "I'd rather be lucky than good." Well, I know that I'm a lot luckier than I'm good. I've been lucky to broadcast some great events and to broadcast the exploits of some great players.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the corner, the great Michigan and Trumbull, the most famous corner in the Midwest.
He struck him out, and Morris has a no-hitter.
And McClain has his 30th victory of the 1968 season.
There's a long drive to right, and it is a home run for Gibson.
And the Titans have won their first pennant since 1945. Let's listen to the bedlam here at Tiger Stadium.
The pitch, he swings, and there's a fly ball to left. Here comes Herndon, he's there, he's got it. The Tigers are the champions of 1984.
Tonight we say goodbye, but we will not forget. Moments like this shall live on forever.
Ernie, before we review your remarkable life and career, let's get to the most present thing. You've accepted the fact that you have terminal cancer, and we're recording this in the middle of the World Series. In your mind, is this the last World Series you're likely to see?
This will be my last World Series, I think. The doctors gave me about 6 months to live, give or take a few months. That was back in July, so I'm hoping to reach my birthday on January 25th, but I'm pretty sure I won't make the baseball season. But you never know. The Lord works wonders, and we'll just wait and see what happens.
Two things that defy, at least two, that defy what people might expect. First of all, in January, you'll be 92. You're remarkably fit and vital and look remarkably well for a man of 92. But on top of it, as you've just acknowledged, you have terminal cancer. You don't look, as I sit across from you here, you don't look like a dying man.
Well, God's been good to me. He gave me good health, and I've tried to keep healthy. And George Romney, the former governor of Michigan, had a great saying, "I want to die healthy." And it looks like I'm going to die pretty healthy. Of course, the final days will be a little more stressed, I know, and full of pain and things like that, but I'm ready for that too. But I was very lucky. I kept myself in good shape. I missed only two ball games in my 55 years, and neither one of those was because of health. So I've just been blessed with good health.
I know you're a person of honest and deep faith. I guess that's what's sustaining you now, because you don't appear to be overwhelmed by the circumstances you face.
No, I'm not overwhelmed by the circumstances. When the doctors came out and talked to me and the family, they They said that this was something that couldn't be cured. It was terminal. And one of the doctors said, if you were my father, I would say just don't do anything, just relax and wait for the inevitable. But I had a great peace about that and a great closure to it. And I knew that God was in charge and that whatever happens, happens for the best. So I really have a lot of serenity and my great support from my wife, Lulu, and the family and all my friends. So it's been so far a fairly easy task to accept it.
Is there anything that remains to give you closure? Anything you feel you need to do between now and the time that you leave us?
No, I just want to take good care of my wife and the family and try to let them be at peace as I go through this process. But I feel very good. I feel a sense of comfort because I know that God's in charge.
Publicly, you had what appeared to be your moment of closure when you addressed the crowd at Comerica Park.
I do want to express my feelings here. It's a wonderful night for me. I really feel lucky to be here. And I want to thank you for that warm welcome.
That was a great event for me. The Tigers asked me to come down and say farewell. And first of all, they asked me to address the team, which was a real honor for me. And Jim Leland was there. He had the whole team gathered around, and I addressed them. And then I went up and talked to the press. And then after a couple of innings of the game between Kansas City and the Tigers, they sent me out there to the microphone, and I said a few words of farewell. And it was very heartwarming to me to see the way people felt about me.
In my almost 92 years on this earth, the good Lord has blessed me with a great journey. And the blessed part of that journey is that it's going to end here in the great state of Michigan.
I have always been tremendously impressed by your vitality. As I mentioned, even now at this stage, approaching 92 and with a serious illness. But when you did your last broadcast, when you were 85 years old in 2002, and I think of myself as a student of this, I could scarcely hear any difference between that Ernie Harwell and the Ernie Harwell I first remember hearing in the 1960s.
And here to begin the play-by-play of his final game as a Tiger broadcaster is Ernie Harwell.
Thank you, Paul Carey, and hi again, everybody. It's been a wonderful association.
Well, I guess the old voice didn't change a whole lot, and as I say, I think it was mainly the genes and the good health that the Lord gave me, and the fact that I enjoyed the job so much. I think I never looked on it as work. It was something that I got a great pleasure out of, being with the people in baseball, getting to know them and traveling with them and being a part of that great fraternity that is the Major League Baseball scene.
You've had a remarkable relationship with fans across the country, but especially throughout Tiger territory. And I would imagine now that the letters and the calls and the attempts to reach out and express what you've meant to people are just too many. It's just so overwhelming, you can't respond to them all.
No, I wish I could. That would be nice if I could sit down and write a letter to each person, because it's been overwhelming. I think we've gotten about 7,000-8,000 letters.
People don't write letters as much as they used
to.
They send emails and texts.
Cards, and I've got the prayer shawls and icons and all kind of things, Catholic mass cards, and people have been so supportive and so loving that I just can't understand it. But it's there, I guess. And I think a lot of it is the fact that I've been around a little while, and every announcer is a conduit between the ball club and the public. Once you settle into a region for 4 or 5 years, whether you're good or bad, you know, they get used to you.
And I certainly want to thank you from the depth of my heart for your devotion, your support, your loyalty, and your love. Thank you very much, and God bless you. All right.
Welcome back to MLB Network's Studio 42 with Bob Costas.
We know that, especially in baseball, because of the pace of the game and the fact that it's day in, day out, the local baseball announcer, if he's any good at all and if he's been around any period of time, has a special relationship with his audience that no network announcer, and probably no announcer in another sport, no matter how good he may be, can exactly duplicate. There's something special about that relationship between the local baseball announcer and his audience. But in your case, it seemed to go beyond what it might have been in other cities. What do you think the reason for that is?
I don't think there's any reason for all this response, except that I was the Tiger announcer, and I showed up and did the best I could, and I tried to be myself, and my whole philosophy was the game is the main thing, and don't ever interfere with the game, because people tune in to hear what the Tigers are doing, what the score is, and no matter who's doing the game, they're going to tune in. So you have to realize that when you do it. And I think the regional or local announcer really has a great responsibility, because people take him to the beaches and the picnics and wherever they go, and he becomes part of the family.
Now the Tigers ready to take the field, and the birds are coming to bat.
It's a great job for people, and you're very lucky when you get that job.
I remember Jack Buck saying that to me when I was a wet behind the ears kid coming to KMOX in St. Louis, and Jack was a national figure doing baseball and football both, but he was at his most iconic in St. Louis, mm-hmm. where when he passed away in 2002, it was almost as if a head of state had died, and people had much the same feeling about him in that area as people in Michigan do about you. And he said to me early on, no matter how fortunate you may be, keep this base in St. Louis. People will never feel nationally about you the way they feel in a local community. Now, of course, I was never the voice of the Cardinals, so it mm-hmm. never got to that extent, but you know what Jack was talking about.
Absolutely. I think it's sort of being like in a comfort zone when you have the job of being the announcer for your local team. You're there all the time, day to day, and they have to listen to you whether they want to or not.
Vanishing breed. Not that there aren't some very, very good younger local baseball announcers, but the circumstances have changed. More games on television, people move around more than they used to, loyalties may be divided. So it seems that even if you took a supremely talented 30-year-old announcer now, he or she could not duplicate what Red Barber or Mel Allen or Bob Prince or Vin Scully still going strong in L.A. or Jack Buck or yourself, and I'm leaving many other worthy people out. The circumstances just won't allow for it anymore, will they?
I think the circumstances are such now that a young man breaking in would have a really tough time to establish himself like the old-timers did. I know when I went to Brooklyn in 1948, there were 16 teams in the two major leagues, and each team had maybe two or one announcer. You had less than 15 or 16 announcers. Now you've got, 30, 32 teams, and they all have six announcers, and you have network games coming in all the time. And
superstations.
X-Radio,
Internet.
Superstations. And people just don't get to zero in on one person. I was lucky to be a part of that group that had the only game in town, so to speak. And they had to listen to you whether they wanted to or not.
And that intense and personal local identification defies logic sometimes. You yourself have said, for example, that all things considered, and many people share this opinion, Vin Scully is the greatest of all baseball announcers. And yet if in 1970 they had swapped Vin Scully for Ernie Harwell, people in Detroit would be up in arms and they'd run Vin out of town and they would have run you right down the 405 and out of Los Angeles, wouldn't they?
I think the announcer you grow up with is your favorite. Everybody has his favorite, and certainly some announcers are better than others. But the main thing is that you're part of the family. And we get letters, from ladies that say, I'm 55 years old, but when I was a little girl, my grandfather would have the radio on when I was in the car with him, and I listened to you, and when I hear your voice, it brings back memories of my granddad. And usually I say, yeah, you probably wanted to hear that rock music, but he made you listen to the ball game.
And we welcome you to a sunny day in Baltimore, a little bit on the cool side. We had slight rain early in the morning, and we are looking forward to American League action.
I think that Kurt Smith, who is something of an authority on baseball announcers, has written several books on the subject. I think he got this about as well as anybody could regarding you. Let me quote from Kurt Smith. If a baseball broadcaster is good enough, lasts long enough, and is possessed of an easy familiarity, he becomes almost an extended member of the family. He evolves into a friend, into a form larger than some voice of an organized and mercenary team. Throughout broadcasting, no baseball manner has spoken more distinctively of friendship as opposed to stagecraft than that of the lyricist, poet, and historian known as Ernie Harwell.
Well, Kurt Smith's been very good to me, and I appreciate those remarks. And I don't know whether they're true or not, but they sound good to me anyway.
He italicized the word friendship.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the great local baseball announcers have that quality. But I think that a consensus would be that you had that quality to the greatest extent, that quality of somehow making people feel as if they were your friend, that they were in the presence of a friend.
Well, I do feel like those people out there were my friends, and I hope I was their friend, because it is a unique association that you have with your listener. And I really appreciate the fact that they take an interest in me, and I don't know that I deserve that, but all I try to do is just be myself. I wanted to broadcast the game that I thought I would like to hear as a listener. And I tried to give the score as often as I could. That was my main concern. Yes.
4-3, Tigers lead. Here's a pitch. It's a breaking ball in for a strike. Senior Smoke mixing them up now with breaking pitches.
And then let the play take over. And, of course, you can't just say ball one, strike one. You have to fill in. And usually I did it with the anecdotes or historical information that maybe nobody else came up with. And just sort of let the chips fall where you may. There are going to be some people that like you and some people that don't like you. And you have to accept that when you start out.
Very, very few people don't like you. In fact, I don't think I've ever come across somebody who said, that's so-and-so Ernie Harwell. Has anybody ever, through all the years, come up to you and said, I cannot stand you?
Oh, I imagine they have, but I've been lucky enough not to hear them too much.
When Bo Schembechler, who, of course, won great fame as the coach mm-hmm. at Michigan and was beloved throughout the state, became briefly the guy in charge of the Tigers, he fired you, inexplicably
right.
fired you. In 1991, in that moment, did you dislike Bo Schembechler?
I think maybe I did, but I accepted it. I knew that everybody could be replaced, and nobody lasts forever. And if you work for somebody, he certainly got the privilege and the right to fire you. And it was a blow to me, but I think in the long run, it's probably the best thing that happened to my career, because it brought some undue attention toward me, and caused quite a hurrah around Michigan and in Detroit. And I recovered. Mr. Mike Ilitch bought the team, and within a year I was back broadcasting for the Tigers. And it was something that I had to accept. And once again, I leaned on my faith, and I knew that for some reason this was happening, and it was eventually going to work out for the best. And that's exactly what happened.
Bo was a very strong-willed man. Did he eventually recognize the error of his ways? Did he apologize?
No, he never did, but I forgave him, and, you know, it's in the past. And he was a great football coach. I had a lot of admiration for him, and I never had any problems with him. It just happened that they felt like they were going in, quote, a new direction, and nobody could explain that, but it happened.
A new direction is sometimes a wrong turn. You could get bad directions. When you crossed paths with him, if you did, after that, was it uncomfortable?
Well, here's two Michigan icons.
I remember there was a dinner at something, and I was sitting in the back, and Bo was the speaker, and as he came out, I tried to shake hands with him, and he walked past me, and but those things happened. He just had a certain attitude about it, and I understood that, and I never really felt close to him, but and I guess there was a feeling of being uncomfortable if I was with him because of the circumstances. But in the long run, it worked out the best for me.
Up next, Ernie Harwell talks about two guys he actually knew, Babe Ruth and Ty Cobb.
Welcome back to MLB Network's Studio 42 with Bob Costas.
Let's turn the clock all the way back. As a lad, you're a bat boy for the Atlanta Crackers. Sometimes minor league teams would play exhibitions against barnstorming big league teams, or the teams be coming north from spring training. When you were the bat boy, did you ever cross paths with big leaguers?
Well, yes, they would come up and play, like the Yankees would come up and play, and on their way back, or the Detroit Tigers. And later on, when I was attending a ball game, Babe Ruth came up and played against the Crackers, and I got his autograph. That's when he signed my shoe. He came off the field, and I sneaked down to the box seats, and it was about the eighth or ninth inning, and Babe came in from right field, and the dugout was on the third base side, and I was right there at the edge of the dugout, and he came in, and I said, Mr. Ruth, please give me your autograph. And he said, well, kid, you ain't got anything for me to sign. I was so stupid, I didn't have a piece of paper. I had a pen, so I put my tennis shoe over the railing, and he signed my shoe.
Do you still have the shoe?
I wish I did, but I don't.
You only had one pair of shoes, probably.
Right.
You went out and played in them, and then...
they wore out all the time.
And that was the end of it.
Right.
Growing up in Georgia, did you know Ty Cobb?
Yes, I knew Ty. I didn't know until I got into baseball, but when I started at WSB, the second year I was there, 1941, Cobb came down to his hometown in Royston, and I suggested that I go down and interview him. And the bosses said, you know, he's not going to talk to you. Don't go down there. And I went down there, and he was just as gracious and warm as he could be. Filled up the whole show. I had a 15-minute show. He took the whole show. He couldn't have been nicer. Then later on, when I did the Masters, on NBC Radio, and he would sit around at Augusta Clubhouse and talk to the golfers. And then later on, I saw him at the different old-timers games and things like that. He was always very cordial and warm to me, but I'd heard a lot of horror stories about Tyrus Raymond Cobb.
So you found Ty Cobb, at least in your personal dealings with him, to be gracious and charming.
Mm-hmm.
And that's counter to what people now believe about him.
And you know, if you look a lot at Ty Cobb's letters, most of them are almost literary, and they're well written, and they are very comforting, and they're very kind and warm, and he certainly belies the personality that most people think of him as the meanest man who ever played baseball.
Could it be because, A, you were a kid, B, or relatively a kid, B, you encountered him outside the heat of competition, and you were a fellow Georgian? Maybe you got the best side of Cobb, because I have to believe that a lot of what we've heard is true.
Oh, I think a lot of it's true, yeah, but I think I was lucky because I did talk to him outside of the competition of baseball, and he was very relaxed then, and I think as he got older, he probably craved a little attention, like a lot of people do, you know, when they get out of the sport, they miss it, and they welcome it when it comes along.
There was a time, if you took a poll in the middle of the last century, 1950, even though Babe Ruth's career was long over, Cobb, by consensus, at least with the sports writers who held sway then, Cobb was the greatest player in baseball history. Then, as the years went along and neither of them took any subsequent at-bats, Ruth became the guy. And then other players came along. Cobb died in the early 1960s. My sense is that he died with some bitterness that his standing was slipping. Is that right?
I think Ty Cobb always had a feeling about Babe Ruth. Cobb was the number one player up until the 20s, no question about that. And most people thought he was the greatest player that ever lived. When he retired, he had 96 records at that point. A lot of them had been broken. But when Babe came in, and he changed the game with a home run, and Cobb was the inside baseball, the strategy, the hit and run, the place hitting, and all that kind of stuff. And I think he resented the Babe, and they were pretty good rivals. And by the time he died, I'm sure that Ty's status had slipped and Babe's had gained in recognition, and he probably resented that.
Somebody said once, I can't remember who, Ty Cobb was the greatest player of the century, but it was the 19th century.
Yeah.
And it just continued, essentially, until 1920 when the lively ball came
mm-hmm.
in.
But that made the difference, and Cobb even challenged Ruth in the home run department one time. He had three home runs in one game to show that he could do it. But I think he looked down on that type of baseball because he'd grown up in the era where you had the hit and run and the squeeze and all those things.
When we continue, Ernie Harwell on his call of Bobby Thompson, shot heard round the world.
It's gone, and then that was it, and then the crowd took over, and I kept my mouth shut.
Welcome back to Studio 42 with Bob Costas and his guest, Ernie Harwell.
Eventually, you become the voice of the Atlanta Crackers, and you're a highly regarded minor league announcer. And Red Barber, who's the voice of the Dodgers, takes ill. The Dodgers need an announcer. But it's not quite that simple, is it?
Red Barber got sick in Pittsburgh on a trip with the Dodgers, and they sent him to the Presbyterian Hospital, and they thought he was going to die. I didn't know that he'd ever come back. And Branch Rickey, his boss, contacted the man that owned the Atlanta Crackers, for whom I was working, and he said, I'd like to have Ernie Harwell come up and replace Red. And Earl Mann said, well, Mr. Rickey, that's fine, but I've got him under contract, and if you'll do me a big favor, maybe you can have Ernie. You send me your catcher from Montreal, Cliff Dapper, and Ernie can come up and replace Red. So I was traded for minor league catcher. That's how I got to the big leagues.
So you go to Brooklyn. Red Barber is their voice, their signature voice. You're there for a short time. And then people who associate you with the Tigers for so long may not realize this, but there were some other stops, one of which was with the New York Giants. Little known fact, on October 3rd, 1951, when the Dodgers and Giants played the third game of their best of three pennant playoff at the Polo Grounds and Bobby Thompson hits the home run, everybody has heard Russ Hodges, the Giants win the pennant, the Giants win the pennant. Maybe they've heard Gordon McLemmon on the Liberty Network. He had a very melodramatic setup of the game and call of the game. And of course, Red Barber's doing it on the Brooklyn side. But there were actually, I've read, five separate radio broadcasts. I think Harry Carey was there mm-hmm. in some capacity. And there was one television broadcast, one of the very first coast-to-coast television broadcasts. And you were the announcer. But the tape, I guess, or kinescope, does not survive.
Well, Russ Hodges and I were the two announcers, and we alternated between radio and TV. And on that particular day, October the 3rd, it turned out that I was going to be on TV, which I thought was, wow, this is a lot better assignment. Poor old Russ with those five radio broadcasts, he sort of get lost. And I'm on coast to coast and by myself on NBC. It's the first sports series ever telecast coast to coast, and this is a historic moment. And sure enough, it happened, and Russ made that great call. And I was on the TV when Thompson hit the home run. I just said, it's gone, and Pafko watched it go in the front row of the seats there for the home run that won the pennant. And there was no record of my voice at all. People didn't record things in those days. And of course, Russ was recorded, and the sponsor Chesterfield got out a record. It became the most famous sports broadcast of all time.
Back a throw. There's a long throw. It's going to be, I believe. The Giants run the pennant. 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 And they're going crazy.
And only Mrs. Harwell and I know I was on that afternoon.
But you remember that you had a simple, because it was television,
yeah,
so you
it was
just
TV.
Had to put a caption beneath the picture, a simple, it's gone.
It's gone, and then that was it, and then the crowd took over, and I kept my mouth shut. And, of course, nobody can prove that one way or the other because there's no existing tape.
I've heard the tape of Red Barber's call for Brooklyn, and once he's established that the ball is in the seats, and the Giants have won the pennant. On radio, he's silent with just the crowd roaring for nearly a minute.
Delivers the correct one on the deep spot to left field. It is a home run. And the New York Giants win the National League pennant, and the polo crowd goes wild.
And McClendon, too, I've heard his tape, and that's a little more dramatic and a little more literary, maybe, but also a good job.
Bobby, waiting. Frank throws. Bobby Sweet takes a long run right there on the left. Going, going, going. The Giants win the pennant.
It was such a great moment. I think it took care of itself.
Very many of the great early sports broadcasters had Southern backgrounds. Yourself, Red Barber, Mel Allen, Lindsey Nelson. It's a very long list. Why do you think that is?
The facetious answer was we were too lazy to work for a living. But I think most of us grew up in sort of a rural atmosphere. There was not much entertainment. As a kid, you would listen to your parents talk about Uncle Joe or Aunt Minnie, you know, and what was going on in the neighborhood. And the people that were around me were great storytellers. They loved to tell jokes, and they loved to tell about other people, and they were interested in people. And I think most all of us, Mel Allen, Red, and all of us sort of inherited that in our Southern upbringing.
Welcome back to MLB Network's Studio 42 with Bob Costas.
You come out of the South, and obviously there are racial issues. You were the broadcaster, after all, for a team that was called the Atlanta Crackers, and you think about all that that implies. You get to Brooklyn a year after Jackie Robinson has broken the color barrier. I remember hearing Red Barber say that with his Southern background, he had to take stock when Branch Rickey brought Jackie Robinson in. Not because he felt malice, but because given the customs that he had grown up with, this was something he wasn't at first comfortable with. How about yourself?
I'd grown up in the South where the custom was a complete separation between the races. But I think what tempered my feeling even before I got to Brooklyn was that when I was in the Marines, I saw that the African Americans were just as good as the white people in whatever they did. So I really had a feeling of comfort when I went up there about the racial issue. It didn't bother me at all. It was a little strange because I'd never seen a black man, you know, play in, against the white competition. But it was there, and I accepted it, and Jackie became a very good friend of mine, and I played cards with him, played golf with him, rode the train with him, and it was the most exciting and most eventful thing, I think, that's happened in sports history, the breaking of the color line by Jackie Robinson and Branch Rickey.
I've heard you tell a story about an exhibition game between the Brooklyn Dodgers and the Atlanta Crackers. And there were threats from the Ku Klux Klan, threats on Jackie Robinson's life if he played at Ponce de Leon Park.
In my second year with the Dodgers, 1949, the Dodgers left Vero Beach and went to Houston to play, and then they were coming into Atlanta. And a fellow named Green, Doc Green they called him, the head of the Ku Klux Klan, he called the Atlanta Cracker owner, Earl Mann, and said, if Jackie Robinson plays in Ponce de Leon Park, he'll be shot. And Earl Mann called the sheriff right away and told him that. And it didn't bother Earl Mann. He said to the KKK head, he said, go to hell, you know, it doesn't bother me. And then I broadcast that series of games. And the Dodgers came in, and with Jackie Robinson, Bert Schotten read the letter that the KKK had written. They had a clubhouse meeting. And in the process of reading the letter, he had all the players around listening, and Gene Hermansky was sort of the wag, you know, and he said, I tell you what, let's do, let's all wear number 42, and they won't know which one Jackie is.
There's always gallows humor in sports, no matter how serious
the
issue.
So they went out and played the game, and they had a good crowd that first night. The ballpark at Ponce de Leon seated about 12,000 people. And the first night, they must have had about 17,000 or 18,000. And then it got bigger. The next day, it got to be about 22. And I think the final day, they drew something like 26,000 people. And it was a great success. Nothing untoward happened at all. And he played, and that was the end of it.
How much ugliness, obviously, no shots were fired, but how much ugliness over the years did you see directed at black players?
Oh, quite a bit, especially in the early days. Jackie got the brunt of it, of course, when I was with him in 48. He had broken in 47, but there was still a great residue of bitterness and prejudice against him. And he'd go into certain towns, and it would get pretty bitter. We'd go into a southern town, like almost southern town, like St. Louis or Cincinnati, and have a Sunday doubleheader. They'd pack the ballpark, and half the people would be black and half the people would be white. And all the African-American folks would be rooting for the Dodgers, and the white people would be rooting for the Cardinals or Cincinnati or whoever was playing. But it was there, and then when we were on the bus with the Dodgers in 48 and 49, the people would gather around the African-American people, and they really worshiped Jackie. He was sort of a messiah for them, and all the interest was focused on Jackie Robinson.
Did you do recreations of ball games? A lot of the early announcers wouldn't travel to the game. They'd get some sort of telegraph report and recreate the game. Did you do that?
When I broke in with the Crackers, everybody did recreations. Even in the major leagues, they did recreations up until 1952. I think the Pirates were the last ones to give it up. But when the Crackers played in Birmingham, we would have a telegrapher in the press box and one in the studio. I'd be in the radio studio, and the telegrapher would send back a message to our telegrapher, Costas up, S1C, strike one call. And, of course, the announcer, in the meantime, he fills in everything. You know, Costas is up. He steps out. He goes for the rosin bag. He wants to wipe his hands off the bat. And the infield's in close. The outfield's around to left. And now Jones out on the mound. He looks in to get his sign from Smith. Here's a windup. Here's a pitch. Curveball on the outside corner. Just hit the outside corner. Strike one called. And then when you... Let's say Costas grounded out to shortstop, you'd get out short to first. That's all you'd get. So you'd have the windup again, the ball hit, and the shortstop goes deep in the hole. He grabs the ball, long throw to first. Got him by a step in the half.
Sometimes the recreated game sounds like it would be more exciting than the real game.
You had to be a lot better actor than you were an announcer, where a dog would run on the field, you know, in his imagination, and he'd describe it because the wire would break down from time to time. And you'd foul off 15 pitches or maybe even have a little rain or an argument. And the wise would say to the guy when he comes home, what was that argument you had with the soul? Oh, we didn't have any argument.
And you might need a rain shower on a day that you had previously described as perfectly sunny and beautiful, right? And then all of a sudden, unexpectedly, in comes the rain.
Yeah, it came out of nowhere.
Still to come, Ernie Harwell on some of the signature phrases that endeared him to Tiger fans.
My other one for the call third strike was he's out for excessive window shopping. He looked at one too many.
Welcome back to Studio 42 with Bob Costas and his guest, Ernie Harwell.
After a brief stint with the Giants, you spend several years in Baltimore as the first modern voice of the Baltimore Orioles. They'd moved from St. Louis as the Browns became the Orioles in 1954. So you see Brooks Robinson break in, and you have a nice little run there. But it's in 1960, when you get to Detroit, that you find your true baseball home.
It's probably the best move I ever made because the people of Michigan have really been super. They're great fans. It's an original franchise. They know their baseball. They have a great passion for it, that and other sports too. And it goes generation to generation, people that, used to come to Briggs Stadium and then Tiger Stadium and then Comerica Park, and they hand it down from generation to generation.
Hang on, the drive to left. That'll be the ball game. It's over the head of Gosha. Willie Horton has a single, and the ball game is over, and the Tigers win it 5-4. Jimmy McClain is one of the first out of the dugout as the Tigers come from behind, and McClain has his 30th victory of the 1968 season.
Can you pick out one call that you most enjoy hearing the recording of, one moment, either because you liked the job you did or because it captures a moment that's special to you?
I think my favorite moment would be between two, the Bobby Thompson home run, because it had historical significance. And my other big thrill on a call was Northrop's triple when I was on NBC radio with Pee Wee Reese, and it beat Bob Gibson and the Cardinals in the seventh game.
Now the set by Gibson, we're ready. There's a swing and a fly ball to center. Here comes Flood, digging hard. He almost fell down. It's over his head for the hit. Cash is rounding third. He scores. Willie Horton rounding third. He scores. Northrop goes into third base. Detroit leads 2-0.
There's never been any element of shtick about what you do. It was always style, not shtick. But you did have a few phrases that were yours, called third strike.
Yeah.
You go ahead.
Well, I had two for called third strike. The first one was, he stood there like the house by the side of the road and watched it go by.
There's a breaking ball in for a strike, and he stood there like the house by the side of the road and watched it go by. Struck him out.
And that was derived from an old poem that I recited when I was a tongue-tied kid for declamation contest. And my teacher made us memorize that poem. And my other one for the call third strike was, he's out for excessive window shopping. He looked at one too many.
Double play, two for the price of one.
Two for the price of one. That was sort of automatic. Most of these things just sort of happened. I didn't contrive any of them, really.
Set the pitch. He swings. Bounding ball. Stopped by Truby for the second one. Really the first two for the price of one for the Tigers. A great play by Truby to end the third inning.
And my home run call was long gone, but I didn't use that until the mid-80s. In fact, when Gibson hit his home run at Tiger Stadium against San Diego in the World Series, I wasn't using long gone even at that time. Sort of started saying, there's a long drive, there's a long drive, it's long gone, and then I abbreviated it, it's long gone, and then people picked it up and seemed to like it, so I stuck with it.
Fielder swings, and there's a fly ball, deep left, might be. Hamilton going back, he leaps, and it is long gone. A home run for Fielder, number 37.
And here's my favorite, maybe everybody's favorite, who's listened to you through the years. Foul ball into the stands, somebody gets the souvenir, and somehow you were able to determine that that fan was from Grosse Pointe or Flint or Saginaw.
Well, the foul ball in the stands just happened, too, and I think it went back to about 1961 when George Kell and I were doing the games, and a ball was hitting the seats, and I just said the fellow from Saginaw caught it or whatever, and then the people began to like that. I'd say it once or twice more, and then I'd walk through the stands and somebody would say, hey, you haven't let a guy from Flint catch one in a long time. Or why don't you let a lady from Windsor catch a foul ball once? And I said, okay, so we did it that night.
And it not only made the connection with people in those towns, but made the larger point that baseball is regional. And your listeners included people from all those places, and some of them maybe only got to one game a year.
Oh, yeah, and then when I went on the road, you know, if I was in New York, it would be Tenafly, New Jersey, or Larchmont, or the Queens, or somewhere like that. If I was in Washington State, it would be Walla Walla. Guy from Walla Walla called it. We tried to localize it a little bit.
Here's the pitch on the way. He swings and fouls it off. It'll reach the seats. Then the man from Walla Walla will take that one home.
Welcome back to MLB Network's Studio 42 with Bob Costas.
Something you wrote that a lot of baseball fans are familiar with, and maybe we should wind things up here, because this is the way you concluded your acceptance speech at the Hall of Fame in Cooperstown in 1981. This is baseball. What baseball has meant to you and to the country. Can you do it off the top of your head?
The whole thing?
Or some portion of
it. Yeah, I can do the whole thing, I think.
Go ahead.
Baseball is the president tossing out the first ball of the season, and a scrubby schoolboy playing catch on a Mississippi farm. A tall, thin old man waving a scorecard from the corner of his dugout, that's baseball. And so is a big, fat guy with a bulbous nose running home one of his 714 home runs. There's a man in Mobile who remembers that Honus Wagner hit a triple in Pittsburgh 46 years ago. That's baseball. And so is a scout reporting that a Sandlot pitcher in Cheyenne is a coming Walter Johnson. Baseball is a spirited race of man against man, reflex against reflex, a game of inches. Every skill is measured, every heroic, every failing is seen and cheered or booed and then becomes a statistic. In baseball, democracy shines its clearest. The only race that matters is the race of the bag. The creed is the rule book, and color merely something to distinguish one team's uniform from another. Baseball is a rookie, his experience no bigger than the lump in his throat as he begins fulfillment of his dream. And it's a veteran, too, a tired old man of 35, hoping that those aching muscles can pull him through another sweltering August and September. Nicknames are baseball, names like Zeke and Pie and Kai Kai and Home Run and Dizzy and Cracker and whatever. Baseball is the clear, cool eyes of Rogers Hornsby, the flashing spikes of a Ty Cobb, and an overage pixie named Rabbit Moranville. Baseball, just a game, as simple as a ball and bat, and yet as complex as the American spirit it symbolizes. It's a sport, a business, and sometimes almost even religion. While the fairy tale of Millie Mays making a brilliant World Series catch and then dashing off to play stickball in the streets with his teenage pals, that's baseball, and so is a husky voice of a doomed Lou Gehrig saying, "I consider myself the luckiest man on the face of this earth." Baseball is cigar smoke, hot roasted peanuts, ladies' day, down in front, seventh inning stretch, take me out to the ball game, and the star-spangled banner. Baseball is a man named Campanella telling the nation's business leaders, "You have to be a man to be a big nigger, but you have to have a lot of little boy in you too." This is a game for America, baseball. This is a game for boys and for men.
You left just one thing out.
What's that?
Ernie Harwell's baseball, too.
Thank you, sir.
God bless you, Ernie.
And I certainly want to thank you from the depth of my heart for your devotion, your support, your loyalty, and your love. Thank you very much. And God bless you.